One thing, the curse on Adam cannot be limited only to actual thorns and thistles. If that were so, then every man who chooses not to be a farmer gets to escape the curse. Take a white-collar job and you're scot-free. No, the meaning is deeper, and the implications are for every son of Adam. Man is cursed with futility and failure. Life is going to be hard for a man now in the place he will feel it most. Failure is a man's worst fear.
In just the same way, the curse for Eve and all her daughters cannot be limited only to babies and marriage. For if that were true, then every single woman without children gets to escape the curse. Not so. The meaning is deeper, and the implications are for every daughter of Eve. Woman is cursed with loneliness, relational heartache, with the urge to control, especially her man, and with the dominance of men, which is not how things were meant to be, and we are not saying it is a good thing. It is a fruit of the fall and a sad fact of history. Isn't it true? Aren't your deepest worries and heartaches relational? Aren't they connected to someone? Even when things are good, is your vast capacity for intimacy ever filled in a lasting way? There is an emptiness in us that we continually try to feed. And can't you see how much you need to have things under your control, whether it's a project or a ministry or a marriage? Are you comfortable trusting your well-being to someone else? And haven't you felt this is a man's world, felt your vulnerability as a woman to be a liability? Most women hate their vulnerability. We are not inviting. We are guarded. Most of our energy is spent trying to hide our true selves and control our worlds to have some sense of security.
When a man goes bad, as every man has in some way gone bad after the fall, what is most deeply marred is his strength. He either becomes a passive, weak man, strength surrendered, or he becomes a violent, driven man, strength unglued. When a woman falls from grace, what is most deeply marred is her tender vulnerability, beauty that invites to life. She becomes either a dominating and controlling woman, or a desolate, needy, mousy woman, or some odd combination of both, depending on her circumstances.
Dominating women.
Think for a moment about the characters of women you dislike, even despise, in movies. That seems a more charitable place to start. After all, they are fictional characters. In The Horse Whisperer, Annie McLean, played by Kristen Scott Thomas, is a sharp, sophisticated New York professional, the editor of a leading women's magazine. She is also an incredibly controlling woman. Annie's daughter is hospitalized in critical condition following a riding accident that takes the life of her best friend, claims her leg, and terribly injures her horse. Understandably, Annie is shaken to her core. But the way she handles her crisis is to dominate. The doctors, the nurses, her husband, even her maimed daughter. At one point, she notices her daughter's IV bag is running low.
You can't leave it to these people.
She steps into the hall, apprehends the first nurse coming by.
Excuse me, my daughter needs a new IV.
Yes, I know. We have her down.
Well, I'd like you to take care of it now, please.
Please is a barely veiled threat, more like, or else. Annie walks back into the room and explains to her embarrassed husband.
You have to stay on top of these people constantly.
She needs no one. She is in charge, on top of things constantly. She is a woman who knows how to get what she wants. Some of us might even admire that. But consider this. There is nothing merciful about her, nothing tender, and certainly nothing vulnerable. She has forsaken essential aspects of her femininity. And then there is the despicable Mrs. John Dashwood in Sense and Sensibility. John Dashwood's father dies at the beginning of the story, leaving his wife and three daughters to the care of his only son, to whom he has bequeathed his entire estate. But with his dying breath, he has commanded that the women be financially provided for through the goodwill of his son. During the carriage ride home from the funeral, Mrs. Dashwood the conniving and greedy sister-in-law, spins a web of manipulation around her husband, John, and by the time the ride is over, both mother and sisters are penniless. Think of Tom Cruise's fiancée at the opening of Jerry Maguire, the one who decks him. "I'm not going to let you do this to me, Jerry." Or Rose's mother in Titanic, "We have to survive." That line is also said by the horrid mother in Strictly Ballroom, and all those villains like Cruella de Vil and Esmeralda, mirror, mirror, on the wall. Notice also that most of the wicked witches are women, or stepmothers. Have you ever wondered why it was that for years, until the feminist movement, it might be noted with some irony, hurricanes were named after women? Now sure, a calculating, heartless man makes a frightening villain, but somehow, it's even worse when she's a woman.
Fallen Eve controls her relationships. She refuses to be vulnerable. And if she cannot secure her relationships, then she kills her heart's longing for intimacy so that she will be safe and in control. She becomes a woman who doesn't need anyone, especially a man. How this plays out over the course of her life and how the wounds of her childhood shape her heart's convictions are often a complex story, one worth knowing. But beneath it all, behind it all, is a simple truth. Women dominate and control because they fear their vulnerability. Far from God and far from Eden, it seems a perfectly reasonable way to live. But consider also this. Everything that does not come from faith is sin. Romans 14, verse 23. That self-protective way of relating to others has nothing to do with real loving and nothing to do with deeply trusting God. It is our gut-level response to a dangerous world. Now, this is not to say a woman can't be strong. What we are saying is that far too many women forfeit their femininity in order to feel safe and in control. Their strength feels more masculine than feminine. There is nothing inviting or alluring, nothing tender or merciful about them. The archetype would be the infamous Lady Macbeth, who asks the gods to unsex her, remove her femininity so that she can control the fate of the man in her life and thus secure her own fate. Controlling women are those of us who don't trust anyone else to drive our car or help us in our kitchen, or speak at our retreat or our meeting, or carry something for us, make a decision that is ours to make, suggest a different dress, agenda, restaurant, route. We room alone when we travel. We plan perfect birthday parties for our children. It might look like we're simply trying to be a good mom or a good friend, but what we often do is arrange other people's lives. Controlling women are the sort of women, as C.S. Lewis said, who live for others. You can tell the others by their hunted expression. Controlling women tend to be very well rewarded in this fallen world of ours. We are the ones to receive corporate promotions. We are the ones put in charge of our women's ministries, can-do, bottom-line, get-it-done kinds of women. Women who have never even considered that our Martha Stewart perfectionism might not be a virtue. We have never considered that by living a controlling and domineering life, we are really refusing to trust our God. And it has also never dawned on us that something precious in us is squelched, diminished, and refused, something that God has given us to bring to the world.
Desolate women. If on the one side of the spectrum we find that Fallen Eve becomes hard and rigid and controlling, then on the other side you find women who are desolate, needy, far too vulnerable. Women like Ruth Jameson in Fried Green Tomatoes. She is naive, lost, bereft of any sense of self. She falls under the abuse of a bad man and hasn't the will to get herself out. Take out the abusive situations and you have a woman like Marianne in Sense and Sensibility, who is far too willing to give herself over to an untrustworthy man. She is desperate to be loved, and she ends up heartbroken. Desolate women are ruled by the aching abyss within them. These are the women who buy books like Men Who Hate Women and the Women Who Love Them, and Women Who Love Too Much, and Codependent No More. They are consumed by a hunger for relationship. A friend of ours, a young man in his 20s, was lamenting the other day about how much his mom calls him. "How often does she call?" I asked, thinking he might be exaggerating. "Every day." "Whoa. Every day is too often for a mother to call her adult son who has left home."
Sadly, desolate women also tend to hide their true selves. We are certain that if others really knew us, they wouldn't like us, and we can't risk the loss of a relationship. They might be women like Tula in My Big Fat Greek Wedding, who literally hides behind the counter when an attractive man walks in her cafe. She hides her beauty behind big glasses and a day of contacts, baggy outfits, frumpy hair, all chosen because they do not draw attention, because she does not believe she is worth paying attention to. Desolate women might be busy women who hide behind, "There's so much work to do." That's how the women in my family learned to handle life. My mother grew up in rural North Dakota. Her parents spent all the long years of their lives in the same house that she was born in. Her father was a cold, detached man. He never spoke the words that little girls long, no, need to hear. She never heard from her father that she was precious or pretty. He never even told her that he loved her, not once. After one terrible day at school, she ran home with tears streaming down her face, deeply hurt, sobbing, with her little girl's heart broken. She risked running to her father for comfort. He pushed her away. Her mother, she knew, loved her. Yet she was not expressive either, but she was clean and incredibly controlling. My mom was not allowed to have friends over to her house to play because they would mess it up. The living room was not for living in, but for looking at. All objects in the house belonged to her mother, and it was not okay to touch them or, heaven forbid, move them. You can imagine, there was no romping in that house. There was no fort building or game playing or dashing about. It was orderly, neat, and soul-killing. One day, while her mother was entertaining guests, my own mother was upstairs using the bathroom. A very good girl, she washed her hands in the sink after first closing the drain as she was taught. Then a very bad thing happened. She could not get the water to turn off or the plug to open. Both were stuck. In a house of rigid rules, one did not interrupt one's parents while they spoke with adults. My mom didn't know what to do. The water ran on. Something was broken. My mom was responsible. She was going to get into trouble. The water was rising. So my mom did what we all do when we are afraid that we have failed and are going to be found out. She hid. She left the bathroom, went into her bedroom, crawled under her bed, and there she stayed, hiding, cowering, afraid. The water in the sink finally overflowed, spilling onto the floor, soaking through the ceiling, and dripped onto her mother's guests. Oops. Her hiding, like our hiding, only made matters worse.
I was afraid because I was naked, so I hid. Genesis 3:10.
One of my college roommates was a very pretty young woman, but she didn't know it. She was kind and funny, intelligent and bright. She was also timid and afraid. She spent her evenings camped out in front of her personal television. Declining invitations to go out, she stayed in night after night, the weeks turning into months. Wounded, heartbroken in ways I could only guess at, she found solace in sitcoms and snacks. Too insecure to enter into the world, she hid from it instead, venturing out only to attend classes and restock her food supply. Hiding women are those of us who never speak up at a Bible study or PTA council or any kind of meeting, who when we pass a beautiful dress in a window say to ourselves, "I could never wear that." We stay busy at family gatherings and parties we can't avoid. We'd rather go to a movie than out to dinner with a friend. We don't initiate sex with our husbands ever. We dismiss every compliment. We relinquish major decisions to others. Like Eve, after she tasted the forbidden fruit, we women hide. We hide behind our makeup. We hide behind our humor. We hide with angry silences and punishing withdrawals. We hide our truest selves and offer only what we believe is wanted, what is safe. We act in self-protective ways and refuse to offer what we truly see, believe and know. We will not risk rejection or looking like a fool. We have spoken in the past and been met with blank stares and mocking guffaws. We will not do it again. We hide because we are afraid. We have been wounded and wounded deeply. People have sinned against us, and we have sinned as well. To hide means to remain safe, to hurt less. At least, that is what we think. And so by hiding, we take matters into our own hands. We don't return to our God with our broken and desperate hearts. And it has never occurred to us that in all our hiding, something precious in us is also squelched, diminished, and refused. Something God needs so very, very much for us to bring the world.
Indulging.
Whether we tend to dominate and control, or withdraw in our desolation and hide, still the ache remains. The deep longings in our hearts as women just won't go away. And so we indulge. We buy ourselves something nice when we aren't feeling appreciated. We allow ourselves a second helping of ice cream or a supersized something when we are lonely. We move into a fantasy world to find some water for our thirsty hearts. Romance novels, a billion-dollar industry, soap operas, talk shows, gossip, the myriads of women's magazines all feed an inner life of relational dreaming and voyeurism that substitutes, for a while, for the real thing. But none of these really satisfy, and so we find ourselves trying to fill the remaining emptiness with our little indulgences. We call them bad habits. Brent Curtis calls them our little affairs of the heart. God calls them broken cisterns, Jeremiah 2, verse 13. They are what we give our heart away to instead of giving them to the heart of God. We daydream our way through traffic. We imagine meaningful conversations or difficult ones where we speak brilliantly. We spend our imaginations on cheap novels, picturing ourselves as the beautiful heroine, winsome, pursued, beautiful. We are endlessly creative in our indulgent pursuits, our adulteries of the heart. Certainly, we do not limit ourselves to just one. Take a moment and consider yours. Where do you go instead of to God when the ache of your heart begins to make itself known? Spending too much money? Gambling? Binging? Purging? Shopping? Drinking? Working? Cleaning? Exercising? Too many movies, sitcoms, talk shows? Even our negative emotions can become indulgences. When we camp our hearts in self-doubt, condemning thoughts, or even shame because those emotions have become familiar and comfortable, we are faithlessly indulging rather than allowing our deep ache to draw us to God.
Unfortunately, our indulgences make us feel better, for a while. They seem to work, but really only increase our need to indulge again. This is the nightmare of addiction. But it goes far beyond drugs. We give our hearts to all sorts of other lovers that demand our attention, demand we indulge again. We taste something that we think is good. Our longings cease to ache for a minute, but later we find ourselves empty once more, needing to be filled again and again. The ways we find to numb our aches, our longings, and our pain are not benign. They are malignant. They entangle themselves in our souls like a cancer, and once attached, become addictions that are both cruel and relentless. Though we seek them out for a little relief from the sorrows of life, addictions turn on us and imprison us in chains that separate us from the heart of God and others as well. It is a lonely prison of our own making, each chain forged in the fire of our indulgent choice. Yet, our lovers have so entwined themselves with our identity that to give them up feels like personal death. We wonder if it is possible to live without them. Yes, we are, each of us, to a greater and lesser degree, still in bondage. But the good news is that God has not deserted us in our bondage. Ezra 9:9.
We need not be ashamed that our hearts ache, that we need and thirst and hunger for much more. All our hearts ache. All of our hearts are at some level unsatisfied and longing. It is our insatiable need for more that drives us to our God. What we need to see is that all our controlling and our hiding, all our indulging, actually serves to separate us from our hearts. We lose touch with those longings that make us women. And the substitutes never, ever resolve the deeper issue of our souls.
Eve's lingering fear.
Every woman knows now that she is not what she was meant to be. And she fears that soon it will be known, if it hasn't already been discovered, and that she will be abandoned, left alone to die a death of the heart. That is a woman's worst fear, abandonment, isn't it? Rather than turning back to God, reversing the posture that brought about our crisis in the first place, which Eve set in motion and which we have repeated ad nauseam, we continue down that path by doing what we can to secure ourselves in a dangerous and unpredictable world. And down in the depths of our hearts, our question remains unanswered. Or rather, it remains answered in the way it was answered so badly in our youth. Am I lovely? Do you see me? Do you want to see me? Are you captivated by what you find in me? We live haunted by that question, yet unaware that it still needs an answer. When we were young, we knew nothing about Eve and what she did and how it affected us all. We do not first bring our heart's question to God, and too often, before we can, we are given answers in a very painful way. We are wounded into believing horrid things about ourselves. And so, every woman comes into the world set up for a terrible heartbreak. Chapter 4. Wounded.
These words are razors to my wounded heart. William Shakespeare. Ah, women, that you should be moving here among us, grief-filled, no more protected than we. Rainer Maria Rilke. Carrie woke on her 6th birthday to the sound of singing. She knew instantly that it was her birthday, her very own day. She opened her eyes to discover that balloons had been tied all around her bed, a colorful canopy. The celebration had begun. Her mom was standing by her bedside holding a coffee cake with a lit candle in it, and her dad was there too, and both of them were singing, "Happy birthday to you." Oh, unhindered joy. Squeals of delight, kisses, hugs, and hoorays welcomed her into this day, just as she had been welcomed into the world 6 years earlier. Her father whispered to his little princess that he loved her. Her mother reminded her again of how happy she was to have such a wonderful daughter. There was no doubt about it. This little girl was delighted in. Life for Carrie was closer for life as God meant it to be for every little girl. She knew that her father cherished her. She was his princess. He was her knight in shining armor. He wanted to spend time with her. Carrie knew her mother loved her and wanted her. Hers was a world where her father protected her, her mother nurtured her, and she was enjoyed. This is the soil a girl's soul was meant to grow in. This was the garden her young heart was meant to flourish within. Every little girl should be so loved, so welcomed, seen, known, treasured. From this place, she can become a strong and beautiful and confident woman.
If only that was how it was for all of us.
Mothers, fathers, and their daughters.
For many centuries, women lived in close fellowship with other women, gathering at the well, down by the river, preparing meals, many occasions for femininity to just sort of naturally pass from older women to younger women. Our intuition, our keen eye for relationship, our ability to grasp matters of the heart made any sort of formal passage into femininity unnecessary. Nowadays, those opportunities are nearly gone. When we meet as women, it tends to be in high-stress situations, corporate meetings with deadlines, ministry meetings with agendas, PTA meetings with concerns. The home is the only place left for this vital transmission of feminine identity.
The way you see yourself now, as a grown woman, was shaped early in your life, in the years when you were a little girl. You learned what it meant to be feminine, and if you were feminine, while you were very young. Women learn from their mothers what it means to be a woman, and from their fathers what value a woman has, the value that you had as a woman. If a woman is comfortable with her own femininity, her beauty, her strength, then the chances are good that her daughter will be too.
From our mothers, we receive many, many things, but foremost among them are mercy and tenderness. When my sons were young and got hurt, their dad would say something encouraging like, "Cool wound." I would hold them close and tend their injuries. Our mothers show us the merciful face of God. We are nurtured at their breasts and cradles in their arms. They rock us to sleep and sing us lullabies. Our youngest years are lived within the proximity of their apron strings, and they care for us in all the meanings of the word. When we get hurt, moms kiss us and make it better. Moms are a bit of a mystery to young girls, but also belong to a club that one day they will join. So little girls watch and learn. Little girls learn how to live as a woman by watching their mothers, their grandmothers, and taking in a myriad of lessons from all the adult women in their lives. But as for our question, that is primarily answered by our fathers.
Carrie's father was present to her. He saw her, and he made it clear that he enjoyed what he saw. He lavished affection on her with his presence, his protection, his delight. There were names he had for her, secret names only they knew. He called her Kitten and Princess and Little Darlin'. Little girls need the tender strength of their fathers. They need to know that their daddies are strong and will protect them. They need to know that their fathers are for them. And above all, a little girl learns the answer to her question from her father.
Remember twirling skirts? We twirled in front of our daddies. We wanted to know, "Daddy, am I lovely? Am I captivating?" From them we learn that we are delighted in, that we are special, or that we are not. How a father relates to his daughter has an enormous effect on her soul, for good or for evil. Numerous studies have shown that women who report a close and caring relationship with their fathers, who received assurance, enjoyment, and approval from them during their childhood, suffer less from eating disorders or depression and developed a strong sense of personal identity and positive self-esteem. But Adam fell, as did Eve, and the fathers and mothers most of us had continued the sad story. They did not provide the things our hearts needed in order to become lovely, vulnerable, strong, adventurous women. No, most of our stories share a different theme.
Wounded hearts.
My friend Sandy was raised in a home with an abusive father and a weak mother. If her dad hit her mother, her mom felt she must have done something to deserve it. When the hitting turned to beating, Sandy came between her father and mother. She tried to stop her dad's cruelty and protect her mom, taking the beating herself. And when her father began to sexually abuse Sandy and her sister, her mother did nothing to protect them. She simply turned away. Sandy's dad began to bring his drunken friends home with him so that they, too, could sexually abuse his daughters. Again and again, her mother did nothing. What do you suppose Sandy learned about masculinity, about femininity, about herself?
Tracy was her parents' second daughter and did not share in the easy intimacy that she saw existed between her father and her older sister. She was uncertain about herself, about his feelings for her. On a trip to a water park, she wanted to play with her dad. She asked him to go down the slide with her in the children's area. He didn't want to. Tracy implored him to come with her. She was afraid to go alone. She wanted him to catch her at the bottom. She wanted to do it together. He acquiesced. She gleefully walked with him hand in hand to the slide, and he went down first as planned. But it was a children's slide, not made for a grown man, and when he came to the end of it, the water was too shallow for him. The force of his landing broke his foot. He was in pain, and it was her fault. That's what her young heart believed. What does that teach a girl about her desires and about the effect of her life upon others?
A woman we'll call Melissa told us, My wound was delivered at birth. My parents had a 3-year-old little girl and desperately wanted to have a little boy. You know what's coming. They brought me to my father for the first time, and he wouldn't even hold me because he was so disappointed I was a girl. I spent my childhood trying to be a good son and prayed each night before I went to bed that I would grow a penis and turn into a boy. Each morning I would wake and check and cry because I was still a girl. How we wish we could say that stories like this are rare. The nature of the assault might be different, but the reason there are so many struggling women is because there were so many wounded girls.
Rachel had a verbally abusive father.
I heard everything I suppose a girl can hear. You are so stupid. You are worthless. I wish we never had you. You make me sick. I grew up believing I was repulsive to my father, and I did everything I could to try and make him like me.
Abusive fathers are a too common horror. Accomplices, broken mothers are a painful reality. Both of them often come from abusive homes themselves, where the cycle of pain is ruthlessly repeated and passed down for generations. You cannot be alive very long without being wounded. The sun rises, the stars follow their courses, the waves roll in, crashing against the rocks, and we are wounded. Broken hearts cannot long be avoided in this beautiful yet dangerous world we live in. This is not Eden, not even close. We are not living in the world our souls were made for. Something's rotten in the state of Denmark and in our own backyards as we journey through the unknown terrain of the moments and months that make up our lives.
Take a deep look into the eyes of anyone, and behind the smile or the fear, you will find pain. And most people are in more pain than even they realize. Longfellow said, "If we could read the secret histories of our enemies, we should find in each man's life sorrow and suffering enough to disarm all hostility." Sorrow is not a stranger to any of us, though only a few have learned that it is not our enemy either. Because we are the ones loved by God, the King of Kings, Jesus Himself, who came to heal the brokenhearted and set the captives free, Isaiah 61, we can take a look back. We can take His hand and remember. We must remember if we would not be held prisoner to the wounds and the messages we received growing up. The horror that abusive fathers inflict on their daughters wounds their souls to their very core. It breaks their hearts, ushers in shame and ambivalence and a host of defensive strategies that shut down our feminine hearts. But at least the assault is obvious. The pain that absent fathers inflict on their daughters is damaging as well, but far harder to see.
Passive fathers. As I said earlier, fallen men tend to sin in one of two ways. Either they become driven, violent men, their strength gone bad, or they become passive, silent men, like Adam, their strength gone away. Lori's dad was present physically, but absent in every other way. A little girl longs to be delighted in by her father, but Lori's dad wanted nothing to do with her. When her elementary school held a father-daughter dinner, Lori desperately wanted to go. She invited her father to come. She begged him to come, but he would have none of it. Lori assumed he didn't want to attend because he was ashamed to be seen with her. As many little girls do, Lori took ballet lessons. She felt so pretty in her pink leotard and tights that she asked her father to please come and watch her dance. He answered her that when she was on a real stage, then he would come and watch her. As you might know, dance classes typically end with recitals, and so the day did come for little Lori to dance on a real stage. Pretty in her shimmering costume, she eagerly waited and watched for her father's arrival. He never came. Later that evening, friends of her father had to carry him into the house as he was too drunk to walk in by himself. Lori's little girl heart believed her dad had gone to great lengths in order not to have to watch her dance.
Debbie's father had an affair when she was young. He was not a violent man. There was nothing abusive about him. In fact, he was kind to her mother, as he was kind to Debbie and her sister. They shared Sunday dinners, went to church together, only he chose another woman. "I guess she wasn't enough to keep him," Debbie said about her mother. Then she paused and said, "I guess we weren't enough to keep him." Affairs and divorces strike at a woman's worst fear, abandonment. They wound not just the mothers, but the daughters as well. The wound is sometimes hard to identify because the transgression seemed to be against his wife. But what does the girl learn?
Jill's father divorced her mom when she was six. In her heart, she was being divorced, too.
They tried to talk about it with us, make it all sound mature and like it's going to be okay. But he was leaving.
Her father did come for visits to take her on outings, but she learned to hide her heart from him.
I learned to cry underwater. When we'd go to the pool, I didn't want him to see me crying.
So many girls learn something like this. Hide your vulnerability. Hide your heart. You aren't safe.
My father was absent much of my youth. He was a man raised to be strong and good. In his era, the primary way a man showed his strength was in providing for his family. But like too many men, my dad worked long hours to provide for us financially and yet withheld the thing we needed most, himself. My father was a traveling salesman. He would be gone for 3 weeks at a time and then be home for a weekend before leaving again. An alcoholic, he often stopped off at the local bar or a neighbor's house to hoist a few before coming in our door. When he was present physically, he was absent emotionally, preferring the company of the television and a glass of scotch to his family. He didn't know me. I guess he didn't want to.
Mother wounds.
My mom was a lonely and busy woman. When I was young, I had to pretend to be sick in order to get a morsel of her attention. I remember sitting at the kitchen table as a young girl, watching her make dinner, when she told me for the first time, but not the last, how devastated she was when she learned that she was pregnant with me. I was the last of four children, too close together, and she wept when she found out that I, the daughter of an overwhelmed mother and an absent father, was coming. You can imagine the effect that has on a little girl's heart.
Chris's dad was not absent. He was, in fact, deeply involved in her life. She loved horses, had a natural gift with them, and he was very proud of her gift. He delighted in her writing abilities and encouraged her to pursue them. He was present and supportive. He enjoyed her immensely, and she knew it. And her mother was jealous. She told Chris that her father was just using her. She spewed venom that her father was cruel and selfish, and the attention he paid her was wrong. Chris's mom belittled her love for horses, never came to a class or a show. She told Chris that in her riding clothes she looked manly and unattractive.
Dana's mother locked her and her brothers and sisters in the closet for hours on end, day after day growing up. Her mother didn't trust them, nor trust babysitters, so she would put them in the closet while she went out. They were not a poor family, but her mother bought the cheapest food possible, stale, moldy bread, overripe fruit. Her mother would feed her little, then wake her up at midnight and demand that she eat a piece of bruised, ugly fruit. She was 21 years old when she tasted her first perfectly ripe pear and wondered over the flavor. The stories of these women and the wounds they received as little girls are all different, but the effects of their wounds and the effects of ours are painfully similar. Some of these stories are extreme. The feelings of uncertainty and worthlessness that they breed are not. What was your childhood like? What lessons did you learn as a little girl? What did your parents want from you? Were you delighted in? Did you know to the core of your being that you were loved, special, worth protecting, and wanted? I pray so. But I know that for many of you, the childhood you were meant to have, the childhood you wanted to have, is a far cry from the childhood you did have. The messages of our wounds and how they shaped us. The wounds that we received as young girls did not come alone. They brought messages with them, messages that struck at the core of our hearts, right in the place of our question. Our wounds strike at the core of our femininity. The damage done to our feminine hearts through the wounds we received is made much worse by the horrible things we believe about ourselves as a result. As children, we didn't have the faculties to process and sort through what was happening to us. Our parents were godlike. We believed them to be right, If we were overwhelmed or belittled or hurt or abused, we believed that somehow it was because of us. The problem was with us.
Lori's father didn't come to her recital. He went out of his way not to come. That was the wound. The message was that she wasn't worth his time. She wasn't worth loving. She felt that there must be something terribly wrong with her. Tracy's father broke his foot. She invited him into her heart's desire, and the result was disaster. The message? Your desire for relationship causes pain. You are just too much. And she has spent the last 20 years trying not to be too much, trying to minimize her desires, trying to find some way to be loved without being too much. She has lopped off huge parts of her wonderful personality as a result.
Debbie's father had an affair. What made it confusing was that in many ways he was a good man. The message that settled in her heart as a teenage girl was, "You'd better do more than she did, or you won't keep your man." After this came a young man who pursued Debbie and then left for no apparent reason. We've known this beautiful young woman for several years now, and one thing has puzzled us. Why is she always working on her life? Why is she always trying to improve herself? Debbie is always looking for something to work on. Prayer, exercise, financial responsibility, a new hair color, more discipline. Why is she trying so hard? Doesn't she know how amazing she is? What makes her search so frustrating is that she doesn't know what is wrong with her. She simply fears that somehow she is not enough. Many women feel that, by the way. We can't put words to it, but down deep we fear there is something terribly wrong with us. If we were the princess, then our prince would have come. If we were the daughter of a king, he would have fought for us. We can't help but believe that if we were different, if we were better, then we would have been loved as we so long to be. It must be us.
Sandy's father abused her, and her mother turned away. It wrought great evil upon her soul. In all that she learned, Sandy came away with two basic things about femininity. To be a woman is to be powerless. There's nothing good about vulnerability. It's just weakness. And to be feminine is to draw unwanted intimacy to yourself. Does it surprise you that she doesn't want to be feminine? Like so many sexually abused women, Sandy finds herself in the awful bind of longing for intimacy. She was created for that, but fearing to look the least bit alluring to a man. She's settled for the persona of the competent and efficient professional woman, kind but guarded, never too attractive, and never, ever in need, never weak. Some women who are sexually abused choose another path, or perhaps, more honestly, they find themselves compulsively heading in another direction. They never received love, but they did experience some sort of intimacy through the sexual abuse, and now they give themselves over to one man after another, hoping somehow to heal the wrongful sexual encounters with sex that has love to it. Melissa's mother was a wicked woman who beat her children with a wooden rod.
I was absolutely terrified of my mother. She seemed psychotic and would play evil mind games. Most of the time we never really knew why we were getting beat. My father did nothing. One thing I did know was that with every blow, my hatred for her deepened. She turned my sister into a fragile mush of a person, and I vowed she would never do that to me. I vowed that I would be tough, hard, like a rock.
This she became, well into her adult life. You see, the vows we make as children are very understandable and very, very damaging. They shut our hearts down. They are essentially a deep-seated agreement with the message of our wounds. They act as an agreement with the verdict on us. Fine. If that's how it is, then that's how it is. I'll live my life in the following way.
It's taken a lot of years for me to sort through the wounds and messages that shape my life. It's been a journey for growing clarity, understanding, and healing. Just last night, as John and I talked about this chapter, I began to realize more clearly what the message of my wounds has been. My mom was overwhelmed with the prospect of having another child, me. The message that landed in my heart was that I was overwhelming. My presence alone caused sorrow and pain. From a father who didn't seem to want to know me or be with me, I got the message, "You don't have a beauty that captivates me. You are a disappointment." When I was a little girl, I would hide in the closet. No one was looking for me. It was just that I felt safer in there. I began this hiding when I was 10 years old, the same year that my family fell apart. We had been living in Kansas in a neighborhood that was everything you would want a neighborhood to be. My sister's brother and I played with the neighborhood kids. No one had fences back then, and all was open range. And school was a place we flourished. I was voted Citizen of the Year. My oldest sister was chosen as a foreign exchange student and was supposed to go to France. My next sister was the star of the school play. My brother was popular and won awards for achievement. You get the picture. It was good. And then we moved, the result of a promotion for my dad, and it was like an atom bomb went off in our family. We had a huge support system in Kansas, much larger and stronger than we had realized. Friends, neighbors, teachers, all were holding us up. When we moved, we no longer had that support, and my family was not strong enough on its own. We fell down like a house of cards. Though my father no longer traveled as often, he worked long hours, often leaving the house before we arose and coming home long after we had fallen asleep. I would think he was away on a business trip far from home, when in reality he was just an hour's drive away. Dad was an alcoholic and was also diagnosed as bipolar, so when he was home, you never knew which father you were going to get. Would it be the happy dad or the raging father? Our home was no longer a refuge, but became a battleground. Meals together often ended with angry words and hot tears. My father's drinking increased, matched only by my mother's escalating pain and resentment. When they were together, barbs flew through the air like poisoned darts. In an effort to escape, my brother stole a car and tried to drive back to Kansas, where life was good. My mother left to stay with her parents for a while, and one of my sisters ran away. Going out to dinner with my father one night, he had too much to drink and began flirting with the waitress, asking for her phone number. It was all too much for my young, lonely heart. Back home, I went to the medicine cabinet and swallowed all the pills I thought necessary to end my life and my pain. I woke the next morning, grateful that I hadn't died, but keenly aware that my world was no longer safe. And so, I made a vow. Somewhere in my young heart, without even knowing I was doing it or putting words to it, I vowed to protect myself by never causing pain, never requiring attention. My job in the family was to be invisible, to cause no waves. If I upset things at all, surely this ship would sink. So I began to hide. I hid my needs, my desires, my very heart. I hid my true self. And when it was all too much, I hid in the closet. Fast forward 14 years. I'm now a newlywed, married to a strong and forthright husband who is not afraid of confrontation, welcomes it even. We would be sitting at the kitchen table, and if the conversation became tense, I was out of there. He would come looking for me. "Stacy, where are you?" Where was I? I was hiding in the closet. Literally. I was embarrassed by my young behavior. I felt foolish about my seeming inability to talk maturely through a disagreement. But I had never seen it done, and I didn't know how. John's slightest disappointment in something I had done triggered my unhealed heart. It took many, many months for John's love and reassurance to begin to penetrate my frightened heart. I still remember the first time we were in the middle of a disagreement and I was able to stay with him in the room. It took all of my will to keep one foot in the room while the other straddled the doorway of the bathroom, ready to retreat and to contrive safety. It was a turning point. I've never hidden in that way again. I did, however, begin to put on weight faster than you would think humanly possible. Unconsciously, I had found a new way to hide. I feared from the start of my marriage that at my core I was and would always be a disappointment to John. that it was simply a matter of time before he realized it, the message of my wound. The wounded little girl inside thought it would be better to hide, and my hiding, just like your hiding, made things much, much worse. John and I have had many years of pain. As Jesus said, "She who seeks to save her life will lose it," Matthew 16:25. The vows we make and the things we do as a result of our wounds only make matters worse.
Wounded femininity.
As a result of the wounds we receive growing up, we come to believe that some part of us, maybe every part of us, is marred. Shame enters in and makes its crippling home deep within our hearts. Shame is what makes us look away, so we avoid eye contact with strangers and friends. Shame is that feeling that haunts us, the sense that if someone really knew us, they would shake their heads in disgust and run away. Shame makes us believe that we do not measure up, not to the world's standards, the church's standards, or our own. Others seem to master their lives, but shame grips our hearts and pins them down, ever ready to point out our failures and judge our worth. We are lacking. We know we are not all that we long to be, all that God longs for us to be. But instead of coming up for grace-filled air and asking God what he thinks of us, shame keeps us pinned down and gasping, believing that we deserve to suffocate. If we were not deemed worthy of love as children, it is incredibly difficult to believe we are worth loving as adults. Shame says we are unworthy, broken, and beyond repair. Shame causes us to hide. We are afraid of being truly seen, and so we hide our truest selves and offer only what we believe is wanted. If we are a dominating kind of woman, we offer our expertise. If we are a desolate kind of woman, we offer our service. We are silent and do not say what we see or know when it is different from what others are saying because we think we must be wrong. We refuse to bring the weight of our lives, who God has made us to be, to bear on others out of a fear of being rejected. Shame makes us feel very uncomfortable with our beauty. Women are beautiful, every single one of us. It is one of the glorious ways that we bear the image of God. But few of us believe we are beautiful, and fewer still are comfortable with it. We either think we don't have any beauty, or if we do, that it's dangerous and bad. So we hide our beauty behind extra weight and layers of unnecessary makeup, or we neutralize our beauty by putting up protective, defensive walls that warn others to keep their distance.
An unholy alliance.
Over the years, we've come to see that the only thing more tragic than the things that happen to us is what we have done with them. Words were said, painful words. Things were done, awful things, and they shaped us. Something inside of us shifted. We embraced the messages of our wounds. We accepted a twisted view of ourselves. And from that, we chose a way of relating to our world. We made a vow never to be in that place again. We adopted strategies to protect ourselves from being hurt again. A woman who is living out of a broken, wounded heart is a woman who is living a self-protective life. She may not be aware of it, but it's true. It's our way of trying to save ourselves. We also developed ways of trying to get something of the love our hearts cried out for. Despite the best face we put on our lives, the ache is there. As the proverb says, "Even in laughter the heart may ache." Proverbs 14:13. Our desperate need for love and affirmation, our thirst for some taste of romance and adventure and beauty is there. So we turned to boys, or to food, or to romance novels. We lost ourselves in our work, or at church, or in some sort of service. All this adds up to the woman we are today. Much of what we call our personalities is actually the mosaic of our choices for self-protection, plus our plan to get something of the love we were created for. The problem is, our plan has nothing to do with God. The wounds we received and the messages they brought formed a sort of unholy alliance with our fallen nature as women. From Eve, we received a deep mistrust in the heart of God towards us, Clearly, he's holding out on us. We'll just have to arrange for the life we want. We will control our world. But there is also an ache deep within, an ache for intimacy and for life. We'll have to find a way to fill it, a way that does not require us to trust anyone, especially God, a way that will not require vulnerability. In some ways, this is every little girl's story here in the world east of Eden.